Very good. Christmas journeys. Many of us are traveling, many of us are not, but that's our theme. Each Sunday, we're looking at a different journey in Scripture that is associated with the story of Christmas. Today, we're looking at Joseph and Mary's journey. And what we're going to be talking about is they had to leave somewhere and go somewhere else. And what we're going to be looking at specifically throughout this month is leaving and finding something. Usually if you leave somewhere, you're going to find something somewhere. And they found family. Now think about it. They had to leave family in order to what? Find family. And that will be the thought that we will have throughout this series. Every week we'll look at somebody new. They left something and found something. So that's the idea behind our Christmas series, which is Christmas Journeys. Joseph and Mary, we know them as the parents, we'll call them generally, of who? Jesus and others. They had other children also. Now, the travel story is found in Luke chapter 2. If you want to go there, you can. We're going to be looking at Luke chapter 2, verse 1 through verse 7. This is really a simple, what I call a simple understatement, one of the most profound moments in the history of mankind. It's like there's some things that happen, there's no way you can really adequately describe it with human words. For example, this week we had several really nice sunrises and sunsets. Have you ever tried to describe a beautiful sunrise or sun or a sunset to somebody? Or type about it? I mean, you say goofy things like, it was beautiful. It was awesome. There were reds and blues and oranges. Does that really capture it? But it's a human attempt. And what we have here is a human attempt to capture what is one of the greatest moments in the history of mankind. Reading in chapter 2 of Luke and in verse 1, it says this. In those days, Caesar Augustus, we're going to refer to him as Augie throughout this, Augie issued a decree that a census should be taken of the entire Roman world. Have you ever done any study of first century history and looked at how big the Roman Empire was? It was quite big. Okay, stretched all the way from Spain, all the way into the Middle East, Egypt, and most of Western, what we would know as Western Europe. In those days, Augie issued a decree that a census should be taken, says, of the entire Roman world. That's going to require a lot of manpower, you think? Now, so sometimes we read words and we don't really dwell on what are these words telling. This is a massive undertaking. It says, this was the first census that took place while Quirinius was governor of Syria. So we have here two names that if you wanted to date the Christmas story, you could go back in ancient history and look these characters up and see the approximate time frame in which they lived. And then it says this, everyone went to their own town to register. You think standing in line at Walmart during this season is tough? You have the entire Roman world, and if they didn't live in the home or the town of their family lineage, they had to travel. Can you imagine what the roads were like? Now, the Romans did have a major highway system, best of the ancient world. But still, when you have thousands and tens of thousands of people moving, you've got grandpas and grandmas, aunts and uncles, you've got husbands, wives, and multiple children, and dogs and cats and lambs and all that stuff. Can you just imagine the chaos? Then it says in verse 4, so Joseph also went up from the town of Nazareth in Galilee. So if you think of Israel, north, south, we have Galilee, Samaria, Judea, the three major provinces. So he's in the town of Nazareth, which is the lower part of Galilee, and he goes all the way down to Judea. He's got a long way to go. And it says he went to the town of Bethlehem, which is the town of who? Town of David. Why? Because he belonged to the house in the line of David. This gives us an idea of what this Roman census was like. Wherever your heritage was from, that's where you would go. Now, these people were very big on their heritage and their lineage, not so much like us. We sort of sometimes don't even know our grandpas and grandmas. Many of us may have never met a grandpa or grandma. We don't know the history of the family. But right now, think about this. If you had to go to the town of your forefather, the one who spawned your last name, and we're just talking about America here. We realize most of us came from someplace else, but when they got to America, where would you go? Have you ever done any genealogical research? Most of us would say, well, Bellevue, but no. Where did the people who were your great-great-grandparents come from? Does anybody here really know? For most of us, we came from somewhere to America. Paul, where? Okay, all of them came from Bellevue. Very good. Okay, somebody else had their hand up. Who's that, Teresa? Is where? Yeah, but when they were landed in America, where did they settle first? In Flint? Okay. Anybody else? Way back. Eden County, Michigan. Very good. Somebody else had their hand up. Who? Okay, my family came over, I can trace them to the year 1500, late 1490s. I know the area of France and Belgium, the border there where they came from. They went to England, and I've got the year, the name of the ship, the captain of the ship, and the names of all of my relatives that were on that ship, and I know they landed in Connecticut. And then the Roscoe spread like a disease across the U.S. But where would you have to go? That's what we've got here. Think about you having to go back. Paul, you wouldn't have to go very far, would you? You could almost walk to Bellevue. So the house in the line of David. He went there to register with his wife, who? Mary, who was pledged to be married to him and was expecting a child. While they were there, the time came for the baby to be born. She gave birth to her firstborn, a son. She wrapped him in cloths and placed him in a manger because there was no guest room available for them or no room where in the inn as we know it. What we're reading about here is a story of a baby. We know the baby as the Savior of the world. That is why this is one of the most profound moments in the history of mankind. It was the Messiah. It was God in flesh. But to the parents and to everybody else they encountered, in their hometown and in the town they were going to and along the road, it was just another baby, another pregnant woman, and another baby going to be born in the Middle East nearly 2,000 years ago. Because no one else really had a clue what was happening here, so they just see a pregnant woman and a guy. Now, as we think about that, we have to understand that in the first century, there were between 175 to 250 million people on planet Earth. Today, there is almost 8 billion, okay? So you can go back a little ways there. 175 to 250 million people. One-third of them resided in the Roman Empire. So this woman being pregnant was one of about 80 million people, 70 million people, something like that, in the Roman Empire. One-third of them resided there. And one-third of those people were in transit, at least at the same time Joseph and Mary were, the same time frame. The infant mortality rate, I did not realize this in the first century. Now, I know we have people here that have lost a child. We have people here that have had a miscarriage. We've had people here in our congregation that have lost a baby at birth, or within the first week or two, and it's a tragic event. But in the Roman Empire, for every 10 children that were born, at least three of them died within the first week. 30% mortality rate. Why? They didn't have hospitals. They didn't have midwives. Brian Krause was not available, our OB. There was no Medicare. There was no insurance, Medicaid, nothing like that. And socially, in the Middle East, when a child was born, the father had the right to choose whether that child would live or die. Every father. If you accepted the child, you would pick the child up. If you looked at the child and you didn't like the way it was formed, didn't like its features, didn't like the color of hair, you had questions about was this really your child or not, you would simply refuse to hold the child, and the child would be placed in the town square to die unless somebody had compassion and came along and picked that child up. That was the entire Middle East. That was a custom. So the father had the determining was the determining factor in whether a child made it. Give Joseph credit. Give Joseph credit because he accepted this child. And we know from Scripture, was the child his? The answer is no. Now they've got to walk, somehow they've got to travel, do their Christmas journey. It's about a 90-mile journey. We're not sure their exact pathways, but we know Jewish people basically had three ways to go from Galilee south down to what we would call Jerusalem, Bethlehem area. The most traveled route, the most the route that most Bible scholars believe they took because of social customs and things like that, would have been approximately 90 miles. How did people travel back then? How did you get to the hospital, ladies, when you were pregnant? Did you walk? Did anybody here walk to a hospital to have their baby? I could ask how many had babies at home, and probably a number of you have. They didn't have that luxury. They had to travel. They were not Romans, so they didn't have horses. Your options for a general laborer, which Joseph was to either walk. Now stop and think right now, all of you. When was the last time you walked 90 miles somewhere? Not have you walked 90 miles in your life. When was the last time you set out on a journey and you walked 90 miles? 90 miles. That's the way most people would travel. If you were fortunate, you might own a donkey. Have you ever ridden a donkey? They're not fun. They and camels are about equal in my mind. I've ridden both. You're bumping along. It's not a horse. It's a donkey. What are donkeys known for? Being rather stubborn. Okay, now imagine, you're on a donkey, you got to go 90 miles. Do you think the donkey looked back at you and said, come on, boss, let's make it in record time? Donkeys would do whatever they darn well pleased. A general walking journey in those days would take you 7 days because of the terrain. If you're riding a donkey, you add time to that. It would take 10 to 12 days. Now, think about this for a moment. Ladies, you know a little bit more about childbirth than the average guy sitting here. You're 8.5 months pregnant, maybe 8.75 months pregnant. You want to walk 90 miles? Yeah, or do you want to ride a donkey? Your choice. And can you imagine how their conversation might have gone when Joseph came up to Mary and he says, hey, honey, got good news for you. What's that? Well, Mary, you know how you always wanted to travel? We're going south. What do you mean south? Like, we're going to Bethlehem. And in her mind, she's been there just a few months ago. She's realizing that's like 90 miles. Can you imagine the look on her face when he said that? And then the conversation on the road. What that would have been like. Guys, some of you have been with a pregnant woman. Are they rational? Who does Augie think he is? Can you just hear her muttering under her breath? Does he think he's a king? No. He thinks he's the emperor. He can do this. Joe, not so fast. I have to stop again. It's not at McDonald's or a truck stop. Can you just hear her? How much further? Because remember, they don't have their phones out. They can't tell how many miles. And they're going up mountain passes and down through ravines. And can you hear Joe getting halfway down a ravine and saying this? uh-oh, we're supposed to be over there. Would she have appreciated that? No. And then when they finally arrived, her looking at Joe sweetly, what do you mean there's no room in the inn? Picture that when you read the story. They would have been like us. It would not have been a pleasant journey. Now, but they're having the Messiah, right? God's angels talk to them, They're human. How would you have felt, ladies? And guys, how's your journey going? Think on that. Marriage. All of a sudden, the Princess Bride just went through my mind. Marriage. Marriage in biblical times was a unique event. It was an arrangement made for the mutual benefit, not of boy and girl, of family and family. That's what marriage was all about. We have to understand this. Biblical marriages were not built on emotional infatuation or physical attraction. See, this is where we as Americans, we read a story about how this guy was betrothed to her. We read about ancient customs where the one family promised the girl or the boy to the other family, and we go, oh, how barbaric, right? I want to feel loved. Let me just ask you for a moment. How has all this emotional infatuation and being attracted to people physically, and that results in dating, which then results in premarital sex for most people, if we're honest. You want to be honest? Doing things you shouldn't be doing unless you're married. Okay, think about that. How has that worked for our American culture? Think about it. Compared to the ancient custom where father and father got together and they learned about each other's religion, about their values, about their work ethics, about their history. And then the father looked at this father and said, I think that my daughter or my son would be a good match with you. What has worked better in history? Well, America's got quite a high divorce rate, right? And we're, think of our just the couples that come together, they sleep together, they live together, never getting married, and then they break up. The average person has 2 to 3 serious relationships in the sense of, think of engagement, before they ever are married, if they ever get married. Think of how our society compares to that society, and you tell me who's barbaric. When this culture will kill millions of babies before they're ever born. Tell me which culture is more archaic, more barbaric. The ancient world, where they had respect for life, respect for values, or ours? Go ahead, dwell on it just for a second. When we look at the biblical story, rather than dismiss it, we need to think deeper and ask ourselves, maybe they knew something that we've lost sight of, the value of human life, the value of family tradition, the value of commitment. You think? You want to think on that this holiday season? We're in such a rush to get to the end of the road, we've forgotten that the process is meaningful also. Jewish marriages were arranged between families and the fathers of the bride and the groom. Now, we've seen the movies, right? And the movies generally portray that type of arrangement poorly. I simply say do a little history research. And there may be some benefit to having families involved in this whole marriage process. A betrothal, it says. We know that as an engagement. People get engaged and unengaged like you do with flavors of ice cream. I love chocolate. Next year, I love, strawberry, whatever. Don't people do that? Betrothals in the Bible were made oftentimes when the people involved, especially the bride, was younger than the male. The average marriage age for a female in the Middle East was 13 to 14. The average age for a male was approximately 25. Jewish customs and social customs entered into that because a man wanted to be able to provide for his wife. And some of us got married at 17 and 18 and 19. How'd that work for you? And in that culture, generally the person had a career, had a business, and he could what? Provide. But the engagement, once that engagement period happened, that was as good as married in our thinking. See, we have whatever it's called today, dating. Used to be called going together, going steady. What's the hot word today? Because it all changes. Is there a term? Do we not know? Fathers and mothers, what are your kids doing? What do they do? What do they call it when they're engaged? Do they call it engagement? Do they have something else? Hooked up? Okay, whatever. See, there's many terms depending on what part of the U.S. you want to go to. Betrothal was the first stage, and it was as good as married. The only thing that was left was to consummate the service. In other words, for husband and wife to actually live together and have sex. This period of time could last a long period of time. Generally, a year to a year and a half. But it could be years if two fathers got together and they had their babies and they did the engagement then. That was possible. Most times, the woman would never see the man. Man would never see the woman because it was handled by who? It was handled by the father, not a marriage broker. So that's what we have to understand as we go into this story to understand how did Joseph and Mary become what? Betrothed or engaged. In many cultures, the bride's father would pay the groom's family a dowry. Think on that. You ever heard of a dowry? From all the movies that we've watched, who pays the dowry? The who? In that case, the bride's father paid the groom's family an entire dowry. That's where we get a lot of our customs today. In the Jewish culture, the groom's father would pay a fee to the bride's family in order to begin the process of negotiating. That fee could be money, but in the average family, money was a luxury. So what else could you barter with? A donkey. Now we know where that donkey came from. It could be an animal. What else could it be? Land, probably not land, but property of some kind, or indentured service. I will work for you for 1 year. That will be the price that I'll pay. There are all kinds of ways of doing this. Now, when I was in Israel, we had about 70 people from from all over Africa come, and we had a meeting one night because the one man wanted to get engaged. He's a pastor when he went back to his country, but he was poor. He needed to have a cow in order to be able to propose to this girl. So all the youth pastors and pastors chipped in money, and we bought the man a cow. He is now happily married. Ladies, now we laugh, but ladies, think about it. Look in the mirror and ask yourself what you're worth. Okay? Three chickens? Rabbit? Frog? What would somebody be willing to... You got off good because a guy will buy, you know, a $10,000, $5,000 ring or maybe a $1.95 out of a gumball machine. No chickens for you, right? This is the way the world was in the time of Christ. The Jewish betrothal was very important. If you offended a woman who is betrothed to somebody else, it's the same penalty as if she was married and had five kids. Betrothal meant you were married, just the final wedding ceremony and consummation was what was needed. But you're as good as what? Married. So we have to understand that. If both parties wanted to end the betrothal, you would actually have to have a legal divorce. And yes, they had divorces in the Jewish culture. It wasn't a matter of taking a ring off and giving it back to the guy or putting it on eBay so he could see it. No, you had to go through an official divorce. Why? Because you're as good as married. It was common custom for the bride that when she would get married, when the wedding ceremony would actually start to take place, that she would join the bridegroom's family and they would live in their house. Usually a one-room addition was built on. You didn't get your own little mansion. Not in that culture. That's the way they lived. And if you go to Israel today and look at the ruins, and a number of you have been to Israel with me, you will see it looks like a honeycomb. That was a housing development. And a rich family would have two rooms. A guy just starting out would go to daddy's house and he would build his own room. And that's where his new bride would come to live. Remember, he's in his 20s. He's an established businessman, making probably about 30 cents a day. The $15 minimum wage was not in effect at that time. So he was making money, but compared to you and I, not a lot of money. And a one-room stone, generally it's a stone-walled facility for your life. How would you like that? You don't even realize what it was like till you go to Israel and look at the size of these one-room homes. From here to there, and about as long as what this is, that is where you lived. Until dad or mom would die off, and then you would get their room. Sounds romantic, doesn't it? That's the way life was. When the groom then would, after the engagement was made, he would go back to dad's house and he would begin to build this. When completed, the groom would then return to fetch his bride. That's what you would do. You come to get her. And here's the deal. The bride never knew when he was coming. Wouldn't that drive some of you women nuts? He said this, "I'll be back." And he would come back. You just didn't know when, but there would be a trumpet sounded when he was approaching. Ladies, that's how much time you've got to get your makeup kit together. Okay? Now, what we've got to understand, in the New Testament, all of the theology and the doctrine that we've just studied about the end times finds its roots in the marriage customs of the Old Testament. Think about what Jesus said, "I will come back, but no man knows the time except the..." Now, what does that mean? When the father would come and look at his son's addition, he would say, or yay or nay. When the daddy gave permission, that is when the son could go back. Doesn't that sound a lot like the rapture to you? So much of it is the teaching of the New Testament finds its roots then. Jesus used that imagery all of the time, the wedding feast. In fact, Jesus is said to be the groom. What is the church called? The bride. And he says, "I'll come back and get you. Be ready," he said. Before the actual ceremony, which would only be attended by a few people, generally the parents, the bride would take part in what's called a ritual washing, a Jewish mikvah. A mikvah is this. What would you call it? It's not a swimming pool. Think of a hot tub. Okay? And the bride would come up, and they have steps that go down into the mikvah, in which she goes in. Now, all Jews did this before they went to the temple to worship. You go into the water, immerse yourself to be ceremonially purified. Does that make sense? The bride did this for both social and religious reasons. The water in a mikvah has to be what they call living water. In other words, it has to be filled with rainwater, a natural spring, or melted snow. It has to be water that has been moving. It cannot just be stagnant. They used it for ritual purification. They also use it for physical purification whenever they went to the temple to make sure it, because any dirt, any grime was symbolic of what? Sin. You had to be cleansed before you go up to the temple of God. Now, this custom, this was huge. Every bride had to do this. It symbolized a separation from old life to new life. As she's going down in there and it's immersed, going under the water, what she's saying is this: the former life that I lived in my daddy's house and as a single person is now washed away. And as I come up out of the water, I am a new person. I am going to be someone's bride. I'm going to live in not daddy's house, but my husband's house. There's a lot of symbolism in the wedding ceremony. It meant this: I'm no longer single. I now see myself as a married woman. It also represented this: I am now dead to the authority of my former family. They have no control over me. I now am under the authority, as she comes out, to someone new. Now think about Christian baptism. Isn't that what we do? The whole thing ties into our Christian faith. After the ceremony, there would be a huge wedding feast. The wedding feast itself included a huge crowd, not just family. Everybody that lived in your village was invited to this. And most Jewish wedding feasts, now some of you have done open houses, things like this. This is a one-week ceremony where you foot the bill. Remember the story of Jesus going to a wedding in John chapter 2? It is an utter disgrace for you to have poor beverages or poor food, or God forbid you run out of something during that week period of time. Now, men, let me ask you, how many daughters do you want to have in your family and have to provide that for every one of them? I mean, a whole village would come. You could have 100 people in a village invited to this feast that you're putting on there. And they're, every one of them are going to critique you. You become the topic of the entire village for an entire week, and if it was a disaster, the rest of your life, you're known as cheapo or whatever, pick your own name. It was a huge deal. Now, the family lineage was critical because the Jewish people knew they belonged to a specific tribe with specific guidelines and promises that managed their life. So who you married was really important. You didn't want to marry somebody from a family that was from the other side of the tracks. And isn't that the same for us? To some degree, yes. So Joseph and Mary had their lineage, if you will, or family tree. It's given to us in Matthew 1 and in Luke 1. Both of those lineages trace Joseph and Mary back to the house of David, all the way back to Abraham. That was critical for a Jew to know who they were from. And the interesting thing is this: both of them knew this in their families, that from us the Messiah could be born. Why? Because we're related to King. There's 12 tribes. Only one tribe could claim lineage back to David, and that was Judah. All the other tribes were nice people and all of that, but if you were from Judah, do you really want to take a chance and marry somebody from Manasseh or some other tribe and lose the possibility of having the Messiah from you? Would you? We would call that not intermarriage. It's not like you're marrying your brother or your first cousin, but somebody in the broader sense of the tribe. You wanted to keep the bloodline, how would we say it? Pure. Now in Matthew 13, Mark 6, both Jesus and Joseph were told their occupation. What is it? Carpenter. Now we've talked about this in church. You really should know this. The word carpenter comes from the word tekton. Tekton. It means architect. You see how the word tech gets in there? It means somebody who is a craftsman. somebody who's a builder, somebody who designs, and somebody who oversees construction projects. Now, we would use a lot of English words to describe that person, but that's who Jesus was. Did he work with wood? We could say, yeah. What's the primary building substance in Israel? Stone. You could call him a stonemason. He used some wood for roofs, but everything else was rock. It's known in Matthew 1 that Joseph was a devout man. We know he was a godly man. We know that he was a compassionate man. Just from the little bit that we are told about their story, all of that could be said of him. The interesting thing about Joseph is after Jesus is 12 years old, we know nothing. Zero. Leads us to believe he what? He probably died. In Luke's genealogy, Mary is just introduced. We know very little about her. Now, I was raised Catholic. There's all the stuff that Catholics tell you about Mary. None of it is in the Bible. So what do we know from the Bible about Mary? She's from the tribe of Judah, related to King David. We know she was a simple girl, but that's about it. Culturally, we can assume her age, 13 or 14. Biblically, we know her family lineage. Socially, we know she was related to somebody down south called Elizabeth. From Elizabeth and her husband Zachariah came who? John the Baptist. That's what we know about Joseph and Mary. That's the wedding customs that led to their journey. You see, they would not have come there and had a baby if they had not gotten what? Married. You have to understand the whole marriage scenario to understand why they ended up in a little place, hamlet, a little hamlet that would make Calamo look huge, okay, or Woodbury. Why? Because they were related to King David. As I studied through this again this week, this is the 28th year that I've done a Christmas series. Do you know how hard it is to take one story and make it different every year? Yeah. Here's what I learned just reviewing the marriage customs. Four things about marriage. Marriage is a covenant with God. Think of the triangle. Here's you, here's your spouse. There's who? It is a legal agreement, not just between the two of you. It's a legal agreement with God. And the visual makes sense that if the two of us will work our tails off to get close to God, what happens to our relationship? Do you see? God becomes the common denominator that pulls you together. Without God, you are here. And it's inevitable as you grow, as you change, as you have new life experiences, one person almost always in every marriage relationship grows apart from the other. And you have to work your tail off to maintain that distance. Does that make sense? But if you have God as the center point, he draws the two of you together. Secondly, it's a commitment to your spouse, and even more important than your spouse. That sounds weird. I commit to my spouse when you get married. You're also committing to her family. Do you realize that? That everything you do in that marriage, whether you're an idiot or you're a glowing success, doesn't just affect your spouse. It affects who? The entire family. We don't teach that to our children enough. That when you marry this person, you're marrying the whole, whether you like it or not. Third is this. There's a commission to represent God to everybody that you encounter. In the Jewish sense, if I marry this person, and it's a biblical marriage in the sense that Jehovah is going to be the singular person in our relationship, our goal as a couple is not to make money. Not to have a retirement home in down south in Bethlehem. No. Our goal is that we represent God to every other human being we come in contact with. Think of that in your own relationship. Is that what husbands and wives do? or their thoughts all about us, all about our children, all about our retirement, where does God enter into that? In a Jewish marriage, it was a commission to represent God to everybody you encountered. And then the fourth element of a Jewish marriage is the word charge. You have a charge to raise your kids, should God give you children, to raise them up to be followers of God. As in the Christian world, we would say to be Christ followers. Marriage is a big deal, folks. All of the prophecy of the end times has its root of symbolism in the Jewish marriage. Do you see just some of the things I've talked about? Marriage is huge. So here's what I came up with for my own life this week. Fill in a couple of things. Joseph and Mary moved from their families to begin a family. And I don't know that we think about that often. They had to leave a family to what? Get a family. To get there, you have to be willing to leave here. Now, for some younger couples, no one's ever taught them that. They're still, one of them is generally still tied to mommy and daddy's strings. You know what I'm talking about? It's, okay, do I go to your family or my family for Christmas or for Thanksgiving? No, you have a family. You have to establish your own traditions. Doesn't mean you can't see mom and dad, but when your life begins to revolve around what you said you left, something's going to be dysfunctional in your own family. In order to get there, you have to be leaving here, and that includes marriage. Do you realize what marriage does to a human being in the best sense? It forces you to mature. It forces you to think and act differently. It forces you to think of the welfare of somebody else besides just who. That's in a good marriage. You become a different person. You should not be as self-centered in marriage as you were as a single person. Here's the second thing I figured out about this Bible text. The family was expanded in ways that neither of them realized. The family was expanded. When you get married, do you have any indication, any thought about what your relationship, me and this person, what you're going to be like in 5 years? 10 years? In Matthew 13, they speak of Jesus and they say, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother Mary, notice, Joseph's name is not mentioned. He's mentioned as the carpenter's son, almost past tense. So the father and mother are identified, but aren't his brothers James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas? And then it says this, aren't all his sisters still with us? Now, all his sisters implies at least what? Jesus was part of a family that had siblings. Have you got any siblings? Do you get along with them? In your family, Brian, you and Keith, who was the perfect one? There you go. Always smart to deflect to somebody else. Can you imagine being in family with Jesus? It would have been impossible. How do you live up to somebody that never sins? Somebody that seemingly is growing every day. He's not the same. He's smarter. He's holier. You know what you do? You beat him up if you get a chance. His family grew. But as they all got married, you're getting in-laws, new sets of grandparents, cousins, nephews. Can you imagine? You know what it's like at Christmas? Look at your shopping list. Who you got to buy for? Jesus was no different than that. But Jesus not only had numbers in his family. Let me ask you this. Do you think that he had a relative that made him a little squirmy, a weird uncle? Somebody who was a total dork? Somebody that he was embarrassed possibly to be around? Think of your relatives. Somebody who would always come up and grab his cheek, Jesus, you're so cute. Do you? Have you got those in your combined family? Those relatives that just make you antsy, a little squirmy? Jesus is no different. He's a human being. One of the things I learned about this, his family expanded in ways that neither of them realized. Jesus was in the midst of a growing family, bigger than mine ever was, with all the brothers and sisters. But it forced Jesus to actually put his faith into action. Because if we can't get along with family, and I struggle with that just like a lot of you do, why do you think you're going to be a good representative outside of this church to others? If we can't resolve relationships in our family, it will be very tough to live in that world and be credible. Would you agree? So one of the things we learn here is as our family grows, as new people come in, as things happen within our family, this is a laboratory to get our faith right so we can take it outside of the family to someone else. Here's a third thing. Their family was impacted by the circumstances of life. When you get married, you have no clue what life's bringing you down the road, do you? Death, disease, accidents, business failures. You didn't sign up for any of that, did you? Except for the words what? Or for better. So see, when we look at Joseph and Mary, they didn't ask for any of the stuff that came their way. Joseph, can you imagine? He's got to accept a baby that's what? Not his. He has to put up the rest of his life, as long as he lives, with the little snickers and tee-hees and glances from people who knew them when they were younger. And they, oh, that's the guy with that woman. Says it's not his. Well, whose is it? Sometimes a look is all you need, right? He had to live with that. He had to walk 90 miles. He didn't sign up for that. He had to shut down his business in Nazareth. He didn't sign up for that. He had a king trying to kill him because of the birth of the child. Did he sign up for it? Do you? One of the things we have to learn is that we have to trust God in life. Because life turns and life changes. And most of the time, it's not all that good. If we fret, if we fall apart when life does for us, you're going to have a very difficult rest of your life. One of the things I've learned, when stuff happens, you have to go to God, because you will never know why some of these things happen, but you have to live with the aftermath of it. Agreed? Fourth thing is their family was committed to God. Both of them make a decision. If this is what God has told us to do, we will do it. We will not second guess. We will not back away. We will embrace whatever it is God has told us to do. Faith leads to obedience. Lack of faith leads to rationalizing and disobedience. And the last thing is this. They came to Bethlehem, and what did they have? A baby. Their family was blessed with the gifts of God and became a family of great promise and great potential. Psalm 127:3 says this, children are a gift. What are they? Yeah. Now think of that as our Supreme Court is dealing with an issue today. Do you know what that issue is? Okay. Children are a gift, and notice what it says, from the Lord. From the Lord. They are a real blessing. Jesus had was the ultimate promise from God and had a tremendous upside, Savior of the world. This holiday season, when you're playing underneath the trees with kids and watching them open gifts and all of that, I want you to look at each child, each little boy, each little girl. It doesn't matter if they're teenagers, because I still see them as little. And what you've got to remember this. God gave them to you, and they are a gift, a blessing. They all have tremendous promise, all have tremendous potential, and we have to treat God's gifts as though they are precious to Him. And that includes our children. This is a story of Mary and Joseph in their journey. A lot of background there, but I think sometimes we lose sight of that and we just listen to the little story and we write it off and we don't think deeply about it. The reason they ended up there and had Jesus is because everything that I've talked about. So, Father, as we sit here today as a congregation, may we have a deeper understanding of the life of Joseph and Mary, but all the stuff that went into their relationship to get them to the point where Jesus could be born. And Father, with every person here, you have worked in our lives, through our families, through the circumstances of life to bring us to this point today. We want to appreciate gift, or the gift of life. We want to treat others well, even when circumstances don't go well for us. We want to live lives that honor you. So as we think of Joseph and Mary, two younger people starting out in life, they like the illustration of the triangle, they stayed close to you and their lives were drawn together. May we do so also. Use us this week, Lord, to represent you in the lives of somebody else, we pray in Christ's name. Amen.